This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Del Schvichtenberg of Carson City, Nevada, a Navy veteran of World War II who volunteered to serve on submarines. We're going to hear about some of the close calls he survived in a Navy career that continued till 1960 when he retired as a chief warrant officer. Why don't you take us back, Del, to that World War II duty on the USS Sandlance, SS-381. What were you responsible for on that boat?
Well, I was in charge of damage control, for one thing. I was chief auxiliaryman on the 381. Auxiliary gang had everything mechanical except for the engines and the distillers for fresh water. Everything else mechanical, hydraulics, air conditioning, ice machine, periscopes.
We're going to hear about that. And the Sandlance was a very accomplished boat in the war. Presidential unit citation. How many enemy ships did you guys sink?
I think it was around 16 or 18. There's a question as to exactly whether, and some were sunk and some were damaged.
And if you're sinking all these ships, and if you can't stay submerged, you have to surface every night. And when you do hit a ship with a torpedo, they know you're in the area. So you guys must have been in a fair amount of danger yourselves.
We sank one ship that we never got a depth charge afterwards, and that was in the Celebes. The convoy kept going and never deviated, and about that time we had cables going down the side. We were in the middle of a minefield, so that was the reason we never got a depth charge after sinking that one.
So you can hear the cables scraping outside, or what?
Oh, yeah, and you can hear the propellers. And you could hear the depth charges hit the water. Then you heard the igniter engage. And then you got the big bang.
I'm sure it depends on how close you are to the depth charge detonating. But what does that feel like inside a submarine when that's happening around you?
Sometimes you would look down at your feet in the deck, and you'd be a half 6 inches up off the deck from the movement at the submarine.
So it would shake the sub so bad, you guys are all literally lifted up into the air off the floor.
Right, and brake light bulbs. There's all kinds of things that would happen. Sword arm, which tells you what speed you're going at, was cranked down on a motorcycle chain and then locked down with a positive lock, and a little over 400 feet in a depth charge attack, it broke that motorcycle chain and the forward torpedo room started to flood. It looked like it was coming down from the torpedo loading hatch. But instead of that, it was shooting up and hitting the overhead and spreading out from the sword arm. We didn't realize where it was coming from. And the loading hatch was always full of dirty laundry of the people lived up in the torpedo room. So that took up a little time to get that out of there. But then, in the meantime, we spotted the sword arm, which looked like a rainbow, and was able to close the valves and secure the flooding.
You were in charge of that damage control?
Yes, secured the forward torpedo room.
Now, I don't want to overstate or understate this, but this is high stakes. You got a lot of lives on that boat that are going to be lost if you don't contain this leak, right?
That's correct.
So were you a little anxious, nervous, scared?
To a certain point, yes. You'd be pretty foolish if you didn't think about it.
How much time do you think you had? Had you not stopped that leak, how long would it have taken to doom you all?
At one time, I didn't think I'd ever live to be 23, and here I am at 96.
You think that was the closest call you guys had down there?
One of them. On the third patrol, we got an aerial bomb that was a hit. It had to be a hit because the port shaft was forced out of alignment by 18 degrees, ruined the reduction gear, and we had a hot run in the number 8 torpedo tube, which was an electric torpedo in there, that we were going to fire at the ship when the Zero spotted us and bombed us. And the hot run in the torpedo tube, the torpedo expanded. We had no idea what condition the igniter, because there's a little impeller that the water arms it with. And if that was being armed due to the circulation of water.
And if it is armed, it's going to blow you guys all to smithereens.
That's right. And it took 600 pounds of air to get rid of that torpedo. And 8 seconds later, it went off. Actually, when that happened, that sort of called off the destroyers that were depth-charging us at the same time. They thought that we'd blown up. They dropped their search. So we had to go from Australia to Mare Island on one propeller. We were out of action for 8 months, or otherwise we'd have been one of the top submarines of World War II.
So you're about to attack a Japanese convoy. You've got the torpedo armed in the tube. When a bomb hits you guys, the torpedo is stuck in the tube.
We were trying to fire at the same time the bomb went off. So we didn't know whether that torpedo was half in, half out, or what.
And whose job was it to figure that out and get it loose?
Well, we had no choice. All the torpedomen, of course. You could tell that the tube was warm and hot, and also that you couldn't get rid of it with 200 pounds of pressure. Ordinarily, you'd no problem with a couple hundred pounds of pressure.
So how do you do that? How do you apply more pressure to expend that torpedo?
Manually.
So that's what the torpedo men are doing?
Right.
And where are you while this is going on?
I was probably in the control room. The auxiliary gang is in the pump room underneath the control room usually. And we also took care of the air manifolds for surfacing and diving.
And so you say you're not sure if it's armed or not. You guys force it out. 8 seconds later, it goes off. Now, does that mean that it would have gone off in the tube had you guys not gotten it out of there, or was it the rushing water from it being shot out that set it off?
Nobody knows. It just happens. You have no way you can see it, feel it, or anything else. It's the only thing you can go by is the tube was still hot. You know that it hadn't went out when you build up pressure to 200, 300, 400, and finally got rid of it at 600 pounds.
So who knows how close you were to all you guys being killed right there, but then when it gets away and goes off, it tricks the Japanese into thinking you guys are done for.
Yeah, that is correct.
So it maybe saved your life.
Yeah, that is right.
That's a little crazy, isn't it?
Well, yes. A lot of it is you have a guardian angel or somebody looking after you or over you. Or beginning of the war, we had an awful lot to learn. We really didn't know what we were up against.
Yeah, there's so many different dangers you're faced with. And I'm wondering, as you describe how damaged your boat was after that incident, and you said you had to go all the way back. Was that dangerous? Were you guys in danger because you were going so slow?
Well, yes, and on the surface. Matter of fact, we passed a English tanker, and the lookouts reported they signaled. Well, by that time, that signal lit right in front of us. They fired across our bow. Well, the skipper got on the radio, and we got apologies all the way back to Mare Island.
I believe it. Well, and we haven't even talked about the incident for which you were awarded the Bronze Star. And to be in your position on a submarine and receive an award like that is fairly unique. Tell me what happened.
Well, we were in the Sea of Okhotsk, which is right between the Sea of Japan and the Russian naval base. We had this convoy come through with two Japanese destroyers and two freighters, unmarked, no flags, We sank them. They were both Russian. But in making this attack, we also had icebergs that were floating along and hit the number one periscope, which was the attack scope, Bennett. And it could only go down a few inches. It was jammed, in other words. So the only thing we could do was cut out the upper bearing in order to get a bigger diameter to take care of some of that bend to keep the feather from that scope going over the other scope, rendering it useless.
Well, and I know this is old hat and obvious to you, but most people listening have never been on a submarine. They don't know how periscopes work. They don't know the impact of this. So can you spell out for us why that was such a severe problem to have that periscope bent?
Well, the periscope is the only connection you have with the outside world to know whether there's ships up there, where they're at, airplanes, whatever you can see. Airplanes usually came in with the sun, and you didn't see them anyhow.
Well, having that periscope bent put severe limitations on the operability of this sub and put all your lives in danger.
That is correct. With the bent one, it puts a feather of water up over the second one, which rendered it useless. So that was the reason we had to get the bent one down to where that feather of water would not go over the second periscope. We had two periscopes. In case one was out of commission, we had another one we could fall back on. One was an attack, which was a very small lens at the top. And the second one was a little stubbier, so there were two different kinds. One of them had radar on it. The attack didn't.
But so you guys have to stay on the surface while you try to fix this, right?
That is correct.
And that puts you in danger.
Yes, we had an air attack. We just barely got up on top of the periscope shears. This was when the skipper took it out 25 miles from the coast of Japan. My second class was an Indian, and he had a good eyesight, and he spotted this plane coming in from Japan, a Coast Guard patrol. So by the time we got down going through the conning tower hatch, that was the first radar contact we had with it, and that was 10 miles. Well, at the speed those Zeros flew, 10 miles don't take very long.
So you're up on top of the boat trying to fix this periscope, and there's a plane coming in, so you have to hustle down below and hope they don't hit you?
Yeah. And we were up about 45 feet above the waterline, and the lookouts were halfway in between.
So what happened when the plane came in?
He went past, came back in with the sun where he could see us. We were actually too close to him when he came over the first time. So he turned around and came in with the sun, and they could see you down to 100 feet, a silhouette, on a good sunshiny day. And he dropped two bombs, near misses, but he got rid of his bomb load.
Well, I think the obvious question is, how did he miss you? Weren't you a sitting duck?
Not really. We had probably 100 feet of water above us.
So you were able to submerge a little bit because you saw him coming?
Oh, yeah. No. We submerged immediately. And like I said, when we cleared the conning tower, the radar had him at 10 miles. And then they had to get the lookouts down and the OD down. We went right on down to 100 feet.
So if your buddy, your second class man, hadn't spotted it when he did, you wouldn't have been down 100 feet.
Probably not.
And you might not be here.
Yeah, right.
So that plane's gone, but you don't know when another one's coming?
The captain went out to 50 miles then, and we moved south to a new area anyway. In other words, we didn't lose too much time between the time that we were working on the periscope to the next station, which was right off of Yokohama Bay.
And so, to actually fix it, What did you have to do?
We cut out the upper bushing, which was about a 30-inch bronze bushing, which kept that periscope steady when it was raised. And our periscope depth was roughly 60 feet. So from 45 to 60, there were about 15 feet of periscope.
So again, you have to surface, and you guys go up there?
We had to drill little holes. The only equipment we had was what we left with, and that was electric drill and a bunch of drill bits and cold chisels and hammers.
So a little bit at a time.
Yeah, one drill, and we'd get a pocket full of those drills, go down and sharpen them, and then go back up. And this is in the middle of a snowstorm.
And this is something we're going to have to hear more about after the break. Del Schvichtenberg, 96 years old, of Carson City, Nevada, is our guest today. You can find photos of him then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.
Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.